Okay, good afternoon. My name is Raheem Rajan. I'm a senior program officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm actually delighted that all of you could join us. It's been a great conference so far, and we're very excited to be here to learn with you all and share some of the things that we're learning. Together I have Adam Newman, who's a managing partner at Education Growth Advisors, Joseph Beck, an assistant professor at the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, Deb Bushway, the chief academic officer and VP of academic innovation at Capella University, and Scott Dalrymple, who's the dean of the School of Liberal Arts at Excelsior College. And we're here to talk about adaptive learning and effectively integrating technology into the classroom. And just a brief introduction about the foundation's work in post-secondary education. We've been working in post-secondary education for the past 5 years. We are deeply interested in innovations in learning, in accelerating learning, in helping students succeed in their academic careers, and also helping colleges and universities serve the needs of learners generally, as well as those learners that are entering from high school and going through remedial subjects, developmental education, for example, or some of those introductory core subjects. And we actually believe, and we have seen some of the early evidence, that there are ways to deliver instruction and learning more optimally to enable their success. And, you know, we're very focused on the success of low-income learners in particular, and that's part of our core missions around equity and the alleviation of poverty in this country. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the broader post-secondary success strategy, but I'm happy to entertain some of those questions if people have them. But personalization in general is one of those areas that we're deeply interested in learning more about, in working with the field together to help shape and define this area. And some of it is really based on the research that we've seen. This is just one example, John Hattie's work in visible learning, which was a meta-analysis of over 800 studies. And some of the research that he surfaced, actually, around the positive impacts of acceleration, formative assessment, feedback, mastery learning, et cetera. These are things that we know from the learning sciences, from the cognitive sciences, and we believe that if we can create ways of implementing this research that is widely known in those disciplines into learning technologies and into new ways of delivering instruction, that we might actually see some radical improvements. And again, it's not just a hope and a dream. I think there's some credible research that has taken place in this field. Some of the work that Carnegie Mellon has led over the past 5 years, both research at their institution with their own learners, who are obviously not the kinds of learners that we're, as a foundation, most focused on. But some of the research that they undertook as part of their Community College Open Learning Initiative program, which will be made available later on this year. Some really interesting results in taking these OLI courses to community colleges across the country and really working with faculty and learners at those community colleges. Another example that I'll highlight is actually a Next Generation Learning Challenges awardee. So as some of you may know, that we have partnered with EDUCAUSE and some other organizations to launch this really innovative challenge to the field called Next Generation Learning Challenges. And as part of the Wave 1, there was an application by Cal State Northridge to redesign some of their introductory math courses. And over the past couple of years, they have collected some very persuasive and rigorous evidence about the effects of those improvements in the delivery of a blended class for those general introductory math courses. And so there are real great innovations taking place across the country, and those kind of more research, evidence-based approaches are directly in line with the work that we're trying to fund. So about this time last year, we started talking to a number of colleges and universities around kind of where they see the field moving, what they see some of the constraints as. And one of the things that was surfaced was just generally speaking how we need more reliable evidence and information about adaptive learning. You know, even just an understanding of what that is. And we engaged education growth advisors to help us understand that marketplace. And Adam Newman will be sharing some of what they researched and discovered in that process. But we also uncovered a couple of other things. And one is that, you know, not a lot of institutions are deeply experimenting with these kinds of approaches. And the few that are kind of doing it in isolation. The other thing that we discovered is that, you know, these solutions, by their very nature, are embryonic and early stage. And so it's actually through the use of these systems and the deployment of these systems that they have the potential to get better. So part of our approach in terms of understanding how we might actually advance our understanding, the field's understanding, is to actually encourage some of the adoption and experimentation of these approaches. So we launched a grant program earlier this year. We've awarded 14 grants to 17 colleges and universities across the country. And these institutions are deploying adaptive courseware of various different modalities, different kinds of forms, and you'll hear from some of these participants about exactly the work they're doing. Different disciplines, different types of courses. You know, some of these courses are fully online, some of them are blended. You know, a few of them are, some of them are in the developmental education space and some are in the general education space. And so we're going to learn a lot over the next couple of years as these courses are deployed, the kind of evidence that is collected. We're pursuing rigorous evidence collection and deployment and really trying to understand both the efficacy but also the valuable information about the faculty experience, the student experience, and what does it take to deploy these. So now I'm going to turn it over to Adam, who's going to tell us more about the work that they did at Education Growth Advisors.
Thanks, Raheem. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you again for joining us. A lot of the material you'll hear and see in the next few minutes is available through a few white papers that we published last spring. So if you want to listen and not scribble notes, I encourage you to do so. Context for us and the adaptive learning work really centered around what we might think of as the disaggregation of learning and the sources of learning within the post-secondary ecosystem. And this is a sort of a framework that we use a lot with organizations that we work with just to help orient them to the fact that increasingly what we see is the increasing sort of consumerization of education, which means a lot of things. I think for the audience here, what it means is increasingly students will be looking for various alternative sources of learning and education in addition to what it is that they seek out at the institutional context, and understanding the role that institutions play within the context of other actors and stakeholders is important. It wouldn't be an IT conference if we didn't see some hype cycles. So, you know, I think when we embarked on this work about a year ago, it was fair to say that there were a lot of interesting innovations capturing a lot of attention in the education ecosystem. And while things have moved a little bit, you know, adaptive learning is certainly one that there was a lot of buzz and a lot of what we would term loose usage of adaptive learning. Our goal in the exercise was not to necessarily define exactly what adaptive learning was, you know, definitively, but it was to help create a sense of the landscape of adaptivity that might exist within a solution ecosystem that you as institutional stakeholders might be considering or evaluating given the needs and objectives of your institutions. And so I think one of the mandates for us and in the work that we did was to try to move beyond the buzz and the hype around adaptive and try to create some frameworks and some taxonomies and some rubrics that might help decision makers like yourself think through the range of options and opportunities that were available there. And so next couple of slides will be definitional and just give you a sense of how we sort of approached it. As Raheem mentioned, this adaptive learning work sat underneath the personalized learning umbrella of the Gates Foundation. And so the first thing that was very clear to distinguish between was the concept of personalized learning as a broad-based umbrella and adaptive learning as one strand of that, albeit one that is very technology intensive, although personalized learning does not necessarily require technology exclusively. So this is where we started in terms of thinking about personalized learning and sort of adaptivity conceptually. And then as we began to drill down into the solution set and looking at the supplier landscape, we tried to draw some clear lines and distinctions around what we were talking about and what we meant by adaptivity. A couple of the things we were looking for in the research we did at the time, we were looking for organizations that had commercially viable offerings. So this was not stuff that was still in the academic lab. This was not stuff that was sort of a great PowerPoint presentation or 3-minute web demo and a cloud of dust, but it was actually a real viable product that institutions and organizations were using. These were also solutions that were drawing upon a broad swath of academic research that many of you are undoubtedly familiar with around intelligent tutoring systems, machine learning, knowledge space theory, memory management, et cetera, and that were drawing on that academic research to infuse and underpin the solutions they had developed. And what we were also very conscious of is, adaptive learning was one element of personalization. And for the audience that we were focused on and the market need we were seeking to clarify a little bit, we wanted to be very clear that it was one of many alternatives that institutions have. Our goal was not to identify leaders. In emergent marketplaces, that's sort of a fool's errand. Our goal was to help a group of initial stakeholders and then the broader marketplace think through the ecosystem of suppliers and the various value proposition that they might bring to an institutional customer or system. And so what we did early on was create, in some levels seems fairly simplistic, but at the same time I think is very helpful, way of organizing and thinking about who these suppliers were, both for-profit and non-profit, and from what angle or vector they were approaching the concept of adaptivity. And so if you look at the Northwest quadrant, this group, the adaptive platform providers, might be what many of you sort of think of as the sort of the quote-unquote true adaptive learning providers. These are organizations that are generally content agnostic platforms that have built an adaptive engine and are sort of dynamically and oftentimes in real time modifying and adjusting learning pathways. In the upper right, in the northeast quadrant, we have the established publishers who at this point, all of whom have introduced in some way, shape, or form adaptivity into their product mix. In many cases, those efforts have been to sort of extend the pull of their textbooks, but increasingly also as they move into courseware, providing a different value proposition than the traditional texts. Southeast quadrant are what we would consider the emergent publishers. These are organizations that generally tend to have almost a courseware model. In some cases, that courseware model is fairly closed. In some cases, it's more open and allows for some customization and flexibility among an institutional adopter. And it's a very diverse and divergent set of players. And in the lower, sort of in the southwest quadrant, we had some of the what we would call the alternative institutional models. Not that they were necessarily doing anything explicitly adaptive yet, but given the scale and what they were doing with their platforms, felt like they were organizations worth paying attention to. Two taxonomies we focused on. Beyond sort of looking at the market, we then surfaced a group of about 75 organizations that had elements of adaptivity and worked them through a filter, ultimately having very in-depth conversations with 8 organizations, spending about 5 or 6 hours in interview discussion with them and also having those providers submit a technology RFI to us that we used. And what emerged out of that were sort of two frameworks, an adaptive taxonomy, which really seeks to get at and understand the dynamics and dimensions against which solutions are seeking to be adaptive. And I think the important part of this is really, depending upon the institutional context of where adaptive might be deployed, really the nature of where suppliers are along this spectrum in each of these categories informs and helps to shape the types of decisions organizations and institutions might make. And the second dynamic we looked at was technology maturity. And so as you think about where these systems or solutions fit within the ecosystem of resources that you have, there's certainly a whole host of integration, reporting, and other issues from a technology standpoint that are critical to understand. All of this is captured in much greater detail, in addition to a series of company deep dive company profiles in the white papers that we published. What are the takeaways? Again, we talked about adaptive is a flavor of personalized learning, one of many approaches, but not certainly by any means the only one. The other, and I think the most important thing, and I think as Raheem alluded to with some of the work the Gates Foundation is doing with their grant program, very few of these adaptive learning providers are what we would consider competitive, in the sense that many of them have very different solution models, different value propositions, and what we would encourage you to do, to the extent that you or your institution is thinking about adopting or exploring adaptive solutions, is to really understand and define what your objectives are and how you want to use those solutions. Some are very much supplemental study aids or things that can be used to augment an existing course. Others are a way to redesign and deliver the entire course, and it's important to push beyond, scratch the surface of these organizations to understand where they can be best deployed, because not every solution provider is right for the context of what organizations want to achieve. The other thing we saw is, in any emergent market, these suppliers don't have all the answers. They're very interested in finding institutional partners and helping them to achieve their objectives, and also, frankly, helping the suppliers evolve what it is they're doing, because a lot of them, frankly, have been developing their solutions in a little bit of a vacuum as they seek and pursue sort of market adopters and market participants. Both two white papers we wrote on this, one sort of focused on the argument, and one that looks more carefully at the taxonomies we highlighted, the supplier landscape, and some institutional decision rubrics are available on our website. They're freely available downloads, and we would encourage you, those of you interested, to check those out if appropriate. Thank you very much. At this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Raheem, and we'll continue our discussion.
Thanks, Adam. So now what we've done is we're going to discuss with our presenters some of what they're doing, some of what they're learning, things that will be of value to all of us. And first, I'll turn it over to Joe, and really for all of you, actually. But I'll start with Joe. Tell us more about why your institution chose to pursue adaptive learning, and kind of why you chose that path as a potential solution.
Okay, so first, a little bit about my background. I come from the intelligent tutoring systems community, educational software that adapts to the learner, and in educational data mining, taking fine-grained educational data to derive actionable scientific knowledge or things we should be doing differently. So in my mindset, this fall I had an opportunity where I got to take over teaching a freshman intro to program design course in computer science. And to be honest, the question of, why would I want to make it adaptive never crossed my mind. Of course I want to make it adaptive. The question becomes how. The other issue is what I'm doing this fall is I'm taking some baby steps, where step one is let's first transition to a blended model where students are learning from online lectures. So that's going to change the model of what to do during class. As soon as that happens, you have to start thinking differently. What am I doing during class time? What other types of data will I need from students to enable me to do that? And once you start down that path, the incremental work to say, how do I want to customize things for each learner, that's not quite so bad. Once you've kind of taken the big step of completely changing up the class, at least that was my thinking. From my philosophical background, this is how learning should be occurring. So that's why I bought into this model.
So, great question. A tiny bit of background about my context. Capella University is wholly online. Our average student age is in the late 30s. So we have adult learners, wholly online. And about 75% of our population is actually in our graduate space. So we wanted to learn about how this adaptive work could help us improve our persistence and our graduation rates for our learners overall. We think it's time to move, even in the wholly online environment, away from a one-size-fits-all sort of response. And we think there's a lot of power in the technology to move into that space. Obviously, adaptive has been around as a concept since, you know, forever. Maria Montessori, B.F. Skinner, we can trace the sort of intellectual roots beyond that. But now I think we have a moment in time where we're able to blend some of our technology capabilities and really make a difference to our learners. We, however, wanted to take a look at really extending the platform. So much more interest in a profile development that followed a learner as long as possible than in a specific course assignment. And I can talk more about that.
Great. Thanks. Excelsior College is somewhat similar to Capella in that our students are also tend to be adult students. Our average age is, I think, around 39 years old. So it's a similar student base. We are an open admission online college. We're a not-for-profit college, but we're large. We have about 39,000 students now. And we've gotten very good at becoming efficient and figuring out the scalability thing. The vast majority of our coursework is online. We also do some competency-based stuff, so that's a big piece too. But we've kind of gotten really good at finding ways to deliver online education efficiently. So for us, adaptive learning is not so much about lowering costs. I think that is a valid reason sometimes to look at adaptive technology and technology in general. That's not so much why we're interested. We're interested in the student learning outcome piece, as Deb mentioned. And we think that there's some real potential there, particularly in developmental coursework, in general ed coursework, which is what we're testing in our pilot. And the reason that we picked our project in particular, we're testing a piece of software called Cerigo, and it's very interesting. We'll maybe talk more about later in another question, but the piece that appealed to me about Cerigo was it was very easy for a professor to figure it out on his or her own without having to kind of have a real fancy artificial intelligence engine that's intertwined with your system somewhere in the, you know, deep in the bowels of the the university. It's something that's pretty easily done by an individual, and we thought that made it very powerful and scalable.
Great. So, Scott, maybe going back to you, tell us a little bit about the kinds of conversations, the kinds of discussions that have to happen, you know, with your faculty, between departments, with leadership, with IT, in order to do this kind of effectively. Like, what kinds of groundwork has to be laid in those conversations?
Well, it, as your question implies, it can be a pretty big deal. Adaptive learning means so many things. It's hard to generalize, but in the case of what we're doing, it really did require buy-in from a lot of different groups, from faculty, from our IT department, certainly, and from a lot of other folks. It wasn't a big issue for us because we like this kind of stuff. I mean, this is our kind of space. We like these innovative technologies and ideas. And again, I think if you're already largely an online institution, it's not such a heavy lift maybe to add adaptive technology and other kinds of technologies to it. But I don't want to minimize the issue of really integrating with your IT infrastructure. A lot of the folks in the audience probably are at this conference, you know, IT managers, and it's a bigger deal than a lot of times the academic side of the house understands. And I think that that's a big part of what you have to understand if you're going to try to do one of these projects.
Deb, I'm curious whether at Capella, you know, given where Capella is and the kind of mission you have, Did you find, were you surprised by either the ease or the difficulty or the kinds of conversations that you had to have?
So it's a great question. You know, clearly Capella has a self-identity as being innovative. But in true innovator fashion, we like what we already innovated quite well, and got sort of protective about, right, about a new way of doing things. And so it really required a strong vision and a strong purpose for that vision, for us to move through some of the current approaches that we have. Because what we were trying to do, so we were working with Cogbooks in a much more of a platform across the entire course. And it's about building a profile about the learner so that it's adapting. I'm not being loud enough. so it's adapting to individuals rather than a rule-based kind of assignment. We've built some of those rule-based assignments ourselves, so we really wanted this platform going across. And the challenge was really one of a strong vision, a strong purpose for that vision, and maintaining that vision throughout the project's application. So we've reiterated a number of times on what are we trying to achieve? Why are we doing this? Because I'm sort of now I'm sort of annoying the IT teams, right? And but then once we get through some of that, there's a lot of enthusiasm. And what I would say is tremendous enthusiasm from the faculty engaged in the work and tremendous enthusiasm from the teams now.
Thank you. Great. Joe, tell us more about kind of the journey that you've taken at WPI.
Sure. So first I want to give some context. Thank my other two panelists for describing their institution. They have adult learners. WPI is a more traditional college. Our average age of students is 20 or 21. It's debatable if they're adult learners. But so in terms of difficulty, in this case it was surprisingly easy because I had to convince myself. I was the instructor. There wasn't an administrator trying to make this happen. I talked myself into it fairly easily. IT integration is not a big deal either, since it's we're starting off small. The hard part is going to be persistence in terms of I don't have this course forever. Once someone else wants to pick it up, how do I create a clean enough infrastructure that's well explained to say, here's an artifact that you really want to pick up and use? And talking with some of the next generation learning people here, they were giving some ideas. There's some interesting workshops they have to help institutions do that type of discovery and understanding. So persistence is what I see as the challenge. Ease of initial adaptation, that's easy. That's the easy part. Sticking around, I'll tell you in a year.
Great, thanks. So you know, each of you are pursuing you know, different types of learning experiences. You're working with different kinds of solutions, you know. There's a lot of diversity in the marketplace. So tell us a little bit more about some of the criteria that you applied in terms of thinking about, you know, what kind of partnership you were seeking, what kind of a technology partner or solution provider. Help us understand the kind of thinking underlying your choices. So Joe, why don't you start?
Sure. So the big thing I was looking for was information that was actionable. I mean that in two senses. One, that once I had it, I could see something I could do with it. And second, I could see a graduated set of responses where I don't want to undertake something, get 80% of a solution, and have nothing at the end, have a mess. So that's one reason. So step one could be let's work on initially adapting lecture. You know, I see how students do Monday night, Tuesday morning. I see a bunch of you had problems with topic X. Sorry, a hand went up. I wasn't quite sure what that hand signal meant. Sorry. So, you know, the next step could be actually revising the course syllabus, creating additional readings. You know, a third step might be creating subgroups of students to work on more focused problem-solving sessions. I wanted something where I could see various degrees of victory. And for me, that was the big necessary condition. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Deb, love to hear how you all thought about.
So basically what we wanted to do is we had a large vision, and our larger vision is really we'd like to see an adaptive platform across the learner life cycle. So that informed our choice. We wanted this this learner profile build out, and we didn't, again, we felt like we can build some assignments that have some sort of rule-based work ourselves that are adaptive within a course. We also wanted to be able to get the data out of that platform, so that eliminated some folks that sort of have a more closed system. So wanting the data, wanting having a larger vision about a longer-term platform really led us to our decision. And because that's sort of a boiling the ocean question, we started with just boiling a cup of water, which is really just a couple of courses that we thought we could learn a tremendous amount from by using this platform.
That's great. So, Scott, you alluded to kind of the usability and the kind of the way you wanted faculty to be able to use that kind of a tool. Can you tell us a little bit more, as you all have kind of dived deeper into the work, some of what you're learning as you engage further and build out these courses?
Sure, yeah. I do want to stress that. To me, that's very important. I think it's often, you know, just like we're talking with phones or whatever it is you want to look at, it's often the user interface is more important than what's under the hood. You know, that, and I think that that's the case often with adaptive learning technology. There's some really amazing, essentially artificial intelligence things going on out there that are impressive. They're sort of like secret Department of Defense black ops things. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Honestly, that's not for us. We're not in a position to take that kind of thing and integrate it appropriately and get it done so it actually helps our students. So what I like is something a little more elegant, something that's it could potentially go viral. The way I think of when I first started using LMSs, you know, a long, long time ago, it really was it wasn't really top down at my institution at the time. It was more creative professors who really didn't know HTML. This gave them a way to go and do something cool with their course. That's what an LMS was at the time. It's still sort of that, but it's moved beyond that a lot. And I think, to me, that's just what excites me. I'm not saying that's the only model or even the normal model of all the things that Adam showed up there. It's what excites me the most. I want to get tools in the hands of professors who are smarter than I am and who are going to be able to do things I never thought of. That's, to me, is power. I believe in crowdsourcing and in you know, leveraging what other people are doing. And that's why I picked, in our case, Sarago, because it's something that's very easy for people to use, and they're already creating things I never would have dreamed of.
That's excellent. So I realize Adam has been left out of the fun, so let's shoot a question to Adam. So Adam, you guys released these reports in the spring. You know, there was some kind of interest. A lot of people downloaded the reports. Tell us a little bit more about what you've learned, A, through the process of building out that research project, but just some of the feedback you've received from people who've read the reports or some of the side conversations you've had maybe with people at the conference. Or
yeah.
Love to get some of your input on that.
Yeah, no, I think it's been a very interesting experience. I think that the thesis that the market is not fully understood by people was sort of validated in the numerous conversations we've had subsequent to that. And I think a lot of folks have responded, this is incredibly helpful because it provides a frame for me to now begin to think about how I engage with this strand. You know, I think we've seen a lot of interest from a lot of different segments. We actually got a call the other day from a top four defense contractor that's, you know, had read the report and is trying to figure out how they bring these types of capabilities into some of the client bases they have. Ironically, they claim that the military is actually far behind the civilian population in the use of these things, which if you actually read the academic literature is a little bit counterintuitive. Mm. But I think the important thing that I would stress is that what's imperative is finding a way as an institution and as sort of market observers to not treat this discussion as sort of a snapshot in time and a nice picture that, you know, is fixed, because this is an incredibly dynamic space. So if you think about even about a month or so ago, Desire to Learn purchased a company called KnowVillage, which is a sort of a tool not dissimilar from Sarago. And so these things are moving into the mainstream.
Right.
And so I think the important thing to think about as an institution, as you observe these marketplaces, is they are incredibly fluid and ever evolving, and there will be lots of ebbs and flows and shifts and changes. And I think what folks have appreciated is having, based on some of the research, an initial frame and a scorecard to help them sort of navigate the decisions they're making, which was our aspiration.
That's great. That's fantastic. It is definitely a fast-moving space. So I'd like to pivot a little bit to talk a little bit about, now that some of these projects, you know, you all are deep in the heart of doing this work and building these courses. I know Joe has already started deploying a course. Tell us what you're learning. Tell us some of the feedback from the learners, from the instructors, et cetera. You know, anything surprising, anything
sure.
that you'd love to share?
I guess if you remember nothing else I said, aim lower. In terms of I have a team of students who are very motivated and they're working on this, and oh, this is easy, here's a 5-minute warm-up, and they'll log into the system, and I'm like, where's your notepaper? And they're like, what? You're going to write all the things that went wrong, right? Oh, no, it's going to work. You know, the 5-minute exercise took an hour. It was nothing that simple. The other big point would be try to set aside your initial biases. In my case, I'm a computer software educational technology guy. I'm thinking, what are all the cool, clever things we can do in software with adaptation? And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a long list of cool, clever things we can do in software. There's a lot of things humans can do as well. How can we use adaptation to drive the instructor's actions? How about course assistants? Are they able to actually do something more useful than run a recitation section? Are we actually able to have students do something, you know, helping each other with peer learning on the basis of this knowledge? So think about who the other actors are in the ecosystem.
Deb.
Sure. So our courses are not deployed yet, but we are learning a tremendous amount at the same time. We're learning about and we do a fair amount of rapid prototyping, but we're learning more about how to do that and how to consider how to take the strengths in our model and move them into a new model. It's a bit of a mindset shift for faculty and instructional designers to make, to move away from the way we've delivered our online courses to an adaptive experience across the course. And I think that the big lesson we're learning is that once people make that shift, they're very excited, but there are some points of pain in getting to that shift.
Scott, love to learn from you all.
I think that the one thing I'll add to this quickly is just we're learning a lot about human motivation and about student motivation. Because when you're dealing with adaptive technology, you can either build it into the guts of the course. It's easy to do in an online course, say. But in many cases, for many of you, you're at traditional institutions, and it's not quite so simple. And then you've got a case where you've probably got an adaptive piece of technology that is in addition to the course. So then the question is, what's the motivation of students to use it? And do you make it mandatory or do you make it optional? In my experience, if I make something optional, then the people who use it are exactly the people who don't need to use it. The students who are already very good and engaged will engage and go out and go to this cool website that you gave them as well. And they thank you for it. I'm not sure how much we move the dial there. I think the power here is for the students who aren't like that. And the key is figuring out how you get them to take advantage of this wonderful technology without, you know, nobody likes to use the word mandatory, but frankly, sometimes I do that.
Okay, thank you. That's great. Thank you all very much. We're gonna open it up to the audience. So if you all have any questions for any of us, we'd be delighted to entertain those questions. So we do have a mic set up in the front. There's also a mic set up in the back, and we have someone. Oh, okay. We have a question up front.
There's actually two questions. The first one is directed at all of you. It says, has anyone been piloting long enough to find out if there's an increase in student retention based on the use of adaptive learning?
No.
Yeah, so this, these groups of institutions, the grants that we made over the summer, you know, Joe's courses have launched in just a couple weeks ago, I believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way the grant program is structured, the courses will run for 3 consecutive semesters. And both Scott and Deb's programs are launching in early 2014. So we will be kind of tracking and collecting these results and sharing them back with the field and learning together.
I just want to say, I do think retention is a great variable, though, in that it partially removes from the course instructor an outcome measure. Like using final exam performance always makes me a bit nervous. But seeing if the student sticks around seems fairer.
Was there a second question?
This one's for Deb. Is change more rapid and responsive due to data outcomes and analysis?
Say it again, I'm sorry.
Is change more rapid and responsive due to data outcomes or analysis?
Due to data outcomes or analysis, the choice.
Oh,
okay.
So, I think if I'm understanding the question correctly, is do we get better change adaptation in response to showing people data? Is that, you think, the threat of it? Okay. So, okay, thanks. Sounds good. So absolutely. I mean, the question I will get over and over is, you know, is this working fundamentally? And so what we are doing to show our folks and it is one of those moments when an aha goes off, when we're able to show some of the existing data and the empirical evidence for this kind of work. So it does move the dial for us when we start to engage in the broader discussions. But we don't have our own data yet, so people are skeptical until it works in our environment.
Yeah. Could I add something? I just want everybody to know that those of us who are involved in this, Gates round of grants, are all being held to a pretty rigorous standard on to answer just questions like that, especially your first question. We are developing true, in many cases, double-blind experiments almost. We're going to have control groups. We're going to be looking at whether or not these things move the dial or not for students. And as much as we're excited about them, we're also scientists at heart, and we will make sure that the data reflects reality.
And this is where also I would just add, I think if you look at the supplier community, most folks are eager to have the opportunity to partner, to sort of work together to sort of uncover and sort of build that data set to evaluate sort of what may work and what may not. And I think that, the challenge, the chicken and egg of holding sort of a set of suppliers accountable for data, is works if you're willing to let them in and sort of find an opportunity to sort of test some of these things. And so I think that's, in the research we did, that was one of the key takeaways in this type of an emergent market. It does take two to dance, and so I think thoughtfully structured and thoughtfully engaged is the way to think about approaching this.
I think I'm going to add one more. I see there's another question, but obviously got us finally excited here. But I think the point here, too, is we have to have both a short-term and a long-term view when we're looking at these data outcomes. I'm not sure we're going to get it right out of the gate.
Yeah.
And so there will be some adaptation based on our findings, and I think we have to remember that as well. And this point you make about motivation as a confound in all of these findings, I think is going to be tough to balance out, but is going to be central longer term.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, now you can ask.
So let's take some of the questions up here in the front.
Okay, I was wondering if the research focuses on adaptation by topic and prerequisite versus different modes of learning, multimodal or, visual or different types. So which approach along adaptation are you taking as a first focus?
We're certainly thinking more in terms of prerequisite knowledge, what are missing skills. In terms of different modalities, I hear a lot of academic talks on that. I don't see a lot of crisp, clean results that here are the visual learners, here are the ones that should do a dance, and I just haven't seen the large effect sizes there. I'm sure there's something in theory. We all have resources we click with, but a good underlying theory for who will click with what are the right dimensions, I haven't seen that, so we have not pursued that avenue.
So we're in a similar, I would give a similar answer. It's definitely a knowledge prerequisite, a pathway of knowledge building that we're using, much more than sort of a learning styles approach. We think that there's we're really interested in seeing the power in that modality.
And same here. We're actually testing adaptive learning software in introductory biology and math courses. And we're using it like so many people when they talk adaptive. They're talking about trying to leverage the power of technology. So the computer is teaching the students the basic stuff, maybe sometimes the stuff you wish they already had known. And then the professors can concentrate on the higher order knowledge and analysis skills. And that is not the only thing adaptive can mean, but it's what it often means, and that is what it is for us.
Great. Thank you. Another question?
I think this previous question touched on what I was going to ask, but I'm curious as to, again, you mentioned some of the courses that you're going to start piloting with, and so I'd like to know, what are each of your plans as to some specific courses, and I'd like to, address one of the concerns I have about adaptive is as you start rolling out more adaptive, and it's very powerful for mastery learning, but what are you thinking about if a teacher starts doing that, will they do that more at the expense of other types of of knowledge gaining, you know, research and contributing with each other. So I just want you to address that concern.
Sure. So I guess I would follow up on the previous comment that if students are doing the mastery and learning, I don't want that happening in the classroom. That seems not a great model. So if students are doing that on their own time in the classroom, if there's something you think pedagogically is more exciting, group activity, solving really hard problems, working interactively with the professor to, you know, on something, you know, challenging, great. I mean, that, I see that as a goal, is to free up class time to not do the lecture, where if I knew that if everyone walking in had this set of competencies for today, I could give I would have a very different 15-minute class time. I almost called it lecture. It would really stop being lecture, and we could start working on some of those items. So I see that as I'm with you in those goals. I think it's a good way to get there. I'm not as scared as pushing it aside.
Yeah, I agree. And it is a big piece of what this represents for us, is the ability to – I mean, when I talk to students from elementary school on up through, in some cases, sad to say, graduate school – they're often dismayed by the preparation their students have coming in. This is not a big headline here. We're all aware of this. And one of the many possibilities some of us see from adaptive learning is the ability to fix that, to have some of the foundational knowledge, I mean, hopefully not learned for the first time, but at least reinforced before the students come to you, so the professors can teach what it is they probably went to graduate school for themselves. And what we have in mind as being college-level work. We don't get very high up Bloom's taxonomy quite often. And if technology can help us get there, then it's a pretty good thing.
I'll give a quick response. I don't think I've said what courses we're doing. And we're doing two very different courses. One is a required first course in our undergraduate business major. And we get a lot of a variety of capability in that course. And we're really leaning into the writing skills. So it's a very it's a bit unusual. When you think about adaptive, I think people often are thinking of sort of fact-based and math kinds of responses. But we're really taking a look at how we can help ideally rehabilitate, but we may be teaching for the first time for some of these adults writing skills that are going to serve them for the rest of their undergraduate education. And the other is a psychology research design course, which, you know, I think gets to some of your point about we can get some mastery, but then we've got some higher order thinking that we've got to make sure we apply. But we can't really apply that higher order thinking well if we don't have mastery. The dialogue becomes meaningless and mishmash and you know, probably harmful in some ways. So we think if we can get to that fundamental mastery, we can then use the real dialogue time in the online course to get to those higher order questions.
I just want to chime in a little bit, because some of the things we're learning from some of the other grantees in the project is really examining that issue of pedagogy and what do you do with the face-to-face human interaction. And what's exciting, actually, is that in many cases, faculty are starting to think and rethink what they've done. You know, so if I'm not lecturing, if I'm not providing that, okay, maybe we could do experiential learning. Maybe we could do other things in that time that push those learners further. The other thing is that some of them are seeing, and folks at ASU, for example, that learners have finished sooner, you know, rather than the whole 12-week semester, et cetera. So there's an opportunity to think, okay, well, what we traditionally thought a student should learn in a certain amount of time, actually, they might be able to learn more than that. And there might be other things that we can provide them in that period of time that would be contributive and complementary. So it's not a reduction of that experience.
Yeah, Raheem, if it's okay, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it didn't necessarily come up as a natural consequence of the questions we've had so far. But I think that one of the most interesting things to me of adaptive learning, the real promise of it, has to do exactly with that. It has to do with time. You know, we most of us started with this arbitrary 15-week semester, which, you know, for whatever reason, and in many cases, online schools and professional study schools and others have gone to 8 weeks and sometimes less and so forth. Whether you like it or not, it's happened. The adaptive learning has the potential to have there be no particular length to a course. A course could be 3 weeks long or 27 weeks long, depending on the student. And, you know, it depends what's going on in that course, whether you're going to like the course or not. But if you did it right, it's really interesting. It allows you to just blow up the whole idea of a semester at all.
and it goes. Another issue. But if you think, if you go back in time and think, you know, we talk about student-teacher ratio a lot. What was the ideal student-teacher ratio? It would be sort of Plato and Aristotle, right? It would be, well, I guess that wasn't even one-on-one. I guess maybe it's the governess model from the 19th century, where you'd have one person teaching you all the things you needed to know. As I understand it, when I read 19th century novels, at least, when I don't think the teacher would arbitrarily spend all fall on French if you didn't need it. They're going to challenge you and then adjust and adapt based on the student and the student's needs and spend more time where they need it. We've gotten awfully far away from that with this behemoth of a structure of education that we have today. We have the potential to go back almost to that, to a one-on-one kind of model. And if used judiciously, that is a very powerful thing.
Yeah, the only thing I would add, you know, we do a lot of work in the K-12 realm as well, and in some ways, if you think about it, what we're really just talking about is differentiating instruction, right? And adaptive is, again, just a tool in the kit, you know, technology-enabled, that allows us to differentiate instruction in ways that, frankly, higher ed has not held its had its feet held to the fire to need to do before. But if we look at sort of the macro and micro dynamics driving this segment and the pressures our institutions are facing and the pressures that the policymakers are putting upon us, what we're really talking about is how do we differentiate instruction so that we drive towards this completion and persistence agenda that we're all pursuing. And so at the end of the day, I would even argue, you know, adaptive becomes sort of a bogeyman as a concept and somewhat scary. Fundamentally, It's a methodology for differentiating instruction that can help all of us and our student learners, you know, proceed at a pace that's appropriate towards their ends and objectives.
That's wrapping up.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, watch this space. This is a really great set of work that has just embarked, and we look forward to sharing more publicly with all of you at EDUCAUSE, as well as just from the foundation itself and all of our great partners. Let's give a round of applause to Adam, Joseph, Deb, Scott for their great work.